Welcome to PARP Inhibitors and Four Common Cancers, a special audio program developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the 2019 American Association of Cancer Research annual meeting in Atlanta. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program features discussion on the biology, research data, and treatment of four common cancers, namely of the ovary, breast, pancreas, and prostate. Our faculty for the program included Dr. Emmanuel Antonarakis on prostate cancer, Dr. Michael Pishvian on pancreatic cancer, Dr. Kathleen Moore on ovarian cancer, and Dr. Melinda Telly on breast cancer. To begin, I asked each faculty member to briefly summarize their broad vision on the genomic nature of the specific cancer they specialize in, with relationship to the typical germline and somatic mutation profile, beginning with Dr. Antonarakis.
About 25% of prostate cancers have a DRD mutation, and about half of those are germline. So you can think of it as a 1 in 4 chance that you'll have a DRD mutation, and then a 1 in 8 chance that that mutation will be in the germline or rising in the germline. Most of those are BRCA2. The second most common is ATM, and then the rest of them are quite rare individually. And the mismatch repair genes are very rare in the 1% to 2% range.
Mike, how do you conceptualize the genomics of pancreatic cancer? How would you compare to what you just heard from Emmanuel about prostate?
Yeah, I think for pancreatic cancer, it's definitely a smaller number. Probably about 3% to 5% of pancreatic cancer patients harbor BRCA mutations. There are other DNA damage repair or DRD mutations that can occur. And when you add it all up, about 17% to 25% of pancreatic cancers harbor these types of mutations. And I think what's most significant about it is that pancreatic cancer is a very difficult disease to treat. And so any opening into a window of another way to be able to treat these cancers is something that we're really excited to be able to jump on top of.
So Melinda, let's talk a little bit about breast cancer, and you've heard these two tumors, which are a little bit late comers to the game, so to speak, but pretty active players now, quickly. How do you conceptualize breast cancer? How often do you see germline mutations in breast cancer patients? And what about the other patients in terms of BRCA-ness or DRD likeness?
Yeah, so I think for breast cancer, this is, of course, one of the classic tumor types associated with BRCA1 and 2. And so we've been clinically testing the germline for these mutations for many, many years now. About 5 years ago, we started to move into more expanded germline testing in breast cancer. And if you look overall, up to 10% of breast cancer is related to a mutation in a single gene, many in the homologous recombination DNA repair pathway. BRCA1, BRCA2, about 6% or so. The next most common are PALB2, ATM, CHEK2, and then there's sort of a smattering of the rarer mutations that make up the rest.
Any comments in general about, you know, what we're learning about the kinds of somatic mutations that occur, Melinda, and what the difference is in terms of sensitivity to PARP or prognosis? Are we starting to get some granularity about the types of DRD mutations?
I think a lot of the studies in breast cancer are still ongoing. We do have some data that shows platinum and PARP inhibitor sensitivity in tumor BRCA mutations that are somatic and not germline. But beyond that, I think it's all still being explored.
So we were just doing a symposium at the SGO 50th annual meeting. Katie participated. And right now, standard of care, one of the things that we went over in the SGO meeting, a woman walks through the door into your clinic with ovarian cancer, she needs to be tested. So Katie, this now is a part of the newly diagnosed, and you're going to talk about why. But again, can you talk a little about your vision of the genomic profile of ovarian cancer, say compared to these other three?
Yeah, so in ovary cancer, not dissimilar to breast, historically, we treated it as a rare tumor, so we lumped everything together as ovary cancer and treated it all the same. Now we're sort of creating these even more rare tumors as we understand the molecular pathogenesis of our cancers a little bit better. So we group high-grade serous and high-grade endometrioid together. And if you look at that group of patients, which is the most common histologic subtype for epithelial ovarian cancer, you find germline BRCA1 and 2 mutations about 18% of the time. It can vary based on geography and sort of population differences in different parts of the globe, but roughly in the United States, 17 to 18%. Germline, if you test the tumor, you'll find an additional 7%. And so roughly 25-ish percent will have a BRCA1 or 2 mutation. And then an additional 25% will have either a mutation in another important gene in the DNA damage response pathway, and some of them have already been listed. Important for us is RAD51C, which does appear to be predictive for response to PARP inhibitors, but there are others, BRK1, maybe PALB2, et cetera, and then you'll find some epigenetic changes to the promoter region of BRCA that also impact response to PARP inhibitors and response to platinum agents. So we really quote about 50% of high-grade serous, high-grade endometrioid patients are DNA damage response deficient in some way or the other, and potential candidates for DNA damage targeting agents such as PARP inhibitors and others.
So just again, to get some basic stuff out there on the table, Emmanuel, you know, we talked about the tumors in terms of, you know, what's inside the tumors, but what about the issue of penetrance in terms of developing the cancer in the first place? Based on kind of what you're saying, it sounds like prostate cancer as it presents is, you know, relatively BRCA-ish or DRD-ish type disease, yet my vision is that people with BRCA germline mutations don't have as many breast cancers. Is that correct or not? You know, lifetime risk of breast cancer, or is that more a function of other sort of clinical variables?
Right. So the word penetrance is a term that the geneticists use to mean if you inherit an abnormal copy of a gene, what's the chance that you will get the clinical phenotype associated with that disorder? And in this case, the clinical phenotype is a risk of developing a cancer. And so most of the data comes from BRCA2, and I'm primarily a prostate cancer specialist, not a breast and ovarian cancer specialist, but my reading of the literature seems to suggest that if you have a BRCA2 mutation and you're a man, your chance of developing prostate cancer is lower than if you're a BRCA2 carrier and you're a woman, where your chance of developing breast or ovarian cancer is much higher in relative terms.
So we're going to explore these themes. We're just really kind of introducing them, but they're going to go throughout the entire meeting. One other theme that you'll see play out through this evening is what's the optimal management, what's the optimal PARP inhibitor treatment paradigm? So if you decide whether, you know, based on germline mutation or somatic, you want to give a PARP inhibitor, what's the optimal paradigm? And even more, I'm curious, you know, from your point of view, Melinda, your thought, are we moving towards a situation kind of like with MSI, where we're going to start looking at the defect and not so much what the tumor is? Just to sort of introduce that, I'll show you the results from a meeting we had recently with some general medical oncologists. I thought this was pretty interesting. So we presented, Melinda, a patient with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, and we said, what's your usual treatment approach? The patient has a BRCA germline mutation. And interestingly, the most common answer was something that has not been studied in breast cancer, which is these docs are using the ovarian paradigm and want to give platinum followed by PARP maintenance because they kind of got used to that with ovarian cancer. We're going to go through this in this meeting, Melinda, but just your initial thoughts. Are we moving toward an MSI sort of tumor agnostic situation? And do you think, you know, eventually we're going to have one sort of strategy based on what a genomic profile is rather than where the tumor was?
I wish it would be that simple. I'm afraid that unlikely that's not going to be the case. I think that there are really a lot of questions whether a germline mutation in BRCA1 is the same as a germline in somatic mutation in BRCA1, whether you have that same mutation in a lung cancer as opposed to a breast or ovarian cancer. Will those tumors behave similarly to DNA damaging therapeutics? I think these are all open questions, and I think it's likely to be complicated.
So let's move on now. We're going to talk about ovarian cancer and again try to weave these themes through the evening. In a second, Kate is going to go through some of the data that's really shaping the way these patients are being taken care of. But one kind of question that really crosses these tumor lines, Katie, is what kind of mutation testing is going to be done? And there's been a lot of debate at the SGO meeting every year. You hear this debated about what the strategy is. The most common answer given in the audience is to start out with germline, but then do somatic, for example, NGS, with the idea that they kind of need both. So if they're germline negative, they need somatic. Is that the way you think this one through, Katie?
I think that's certainly the most accurate, or there's tests right now that are doing them simultaneously with circulating tumor DNA, you know, and not even a tissue screen. So there's lots of technologies out there. This one certainly covers all of our bases. So if you do, and I mentioned this, if you test for the germline, which importantly you need to do, not only because it's predictive for response to PARP inhibition and prognostic for our patients, but also it allows you to do cascade testing for first and second degree relatives and ideally prevent them from ever becoming my patient, which is my goal. I would love to not see these women in the future with ovarian cancer. So that's the importance of the germline. And then, of course, somatic testing, and we can talk about this more, at least in ovarian cancer, there's really no reason to think that a somatic mutation in BRCA1 or 2 responds differently, at least in the recurrent setting. They've been very consistent with germline mutations. And so you want to identify that 7% of patients because it does open up a very effective therapy to them, especially in the frontline following chemotherapy. This is an expensive way to do things. There are other suggestive alternatives. People want to start with somatic and reflex to germline. You're going to miss about 5% of your germlines doing that. And so I think as a society, we have to figure out if that's acceptable to miss the opportunity to prevent basically lethal cancers in women in 5% of the time. So I think it's still up in the air. But I'm glad we're talking about it because the U.S. is really behind where we should be in testing women. And so this conversation that's happening as a result of SOLO-1, I think, is bringing our patients awareness, and they're coming in demanding this test finally. And so I think we're going to get a lot more women tested and taken care of.
Yeah, I was really shocked when I got out of the airplane in Honolulu and went down. There was this huge, you know, promotional sign saying women aren't being tested, which shocked me. Is that really true?
That's absolutely
true. Ovarian cancer, women are not getting tested.
It's absolutely true.
That's really amazing to me. Mike, just sort of a side question to you that we started to hear about. I've heard about this from Memorial. I don't know whether other places. It's a very practical issue of informed consent to the patients that are going to get BRCA testing who has no family history, for example, where you're really doing it for therapeutic purposes. And theoretically, you're supposed to send these patients to a genetic counselor, but I mean, you're doing a therapeutic marker also. What do you think about the idea? And again, Memorial's tried this, of using sort of a video. They give the patient an iPad in the waiting room, and they watch a genetic counselor kind of go through the stuff. And then if they're positive, they get referred. Do you do anything like that? What do you think about that kind of concept?
I think it's reasonable, because I think the idea is that you just have to inform patients that what they're getting themselves into for the testing. I can tell you, I wanted to share in pancreatic cancer that there's good data that 40% of pancreatic cancer patients who are known to harbor germline BRCA1, BRCA2 mutations have absolutely no family history. So the NCCN guidelines actually were updated last year to say that all pancreatic cancer patients should at the very least be considered, I would argue maybe even taking it a step further and testing everybody for germline for pancreatic cancer mutations. But the idea of providing them informed consent, I think doing it through a video, actually at Georgetown we have one of our genetic counselor groups that have established a phone-based consent.
That makes sense too.
So there are different ways to do it just to be able to inform the patient of what they're getting themselves into.
Getting back to the type of testing, Katie, I was kind of struck. There was a big presentation at SGO, and it looked like there's not a total overlap between germline and somatic. That somatic misses some of the germline and germline misses some of this. Is that your take? And that really you can't be sure you're not going to miss anything unless you do both. Is that your take?
I mean, that's true. So if you do germline only for BRCA, just talking about BRCA, you're going to miss 7% of somatic BRCA. If you only do somatic, and there are different somatic assays, but there's one that we looked at in SOLO-1, for example, so I have that data, where we know we missed 5% of the germline. We knew all the patients in SOLO-1 were germline positive, and we missed 5% of them by just doing this one assay, because you miss large rearrangements, there's different call coverage, there's different classifications of variants, so there's all sorts of ways you can miss things. And that's just talking about BRCA, which is the most prevalent, but it's not necessarily the only story. So again, RAD51C, we want to identify that as well. That's an important gene, and we're learning, and these are 1.5 to 1% prevalent genes, and so it's going to take time to figure out which ones are predictive and which ones are not. But if we don't test, we're not going to find them, and they may be very important to patients. This is really a discussion about individualizing therapy and figuring out what each individual patient has, and BRCA is very important. And we have to test everybody, period.
We were here last night talking about lung cancer. You know, lung cancer, now we're looking for NTRK and ALK and things that are 1% or 2% of lung cancer. So that is kind of becoming, it seems like, where oncology is heading. That is the ultimate personalized medicine. Before we go through some of the clinical management paradigms real quick in ovarian cancer, just to kind of quickly go down the line about this issue. You're going to get into it more with your talk, but I just sort of want to get out on the table. Melinda, if you have a patient with breast cancer, I know it may be different, obviously different, but in general, what's your strategy? And you want to assess mutation status. In general, what do you think is the most effective strategy for docs in practice? NGS, germline reflex, germline, and how do you approach breast cancer?
Yeah, I mean, I think both strategies are commonly used. Certainly, if you look in breast cancer and the indications for PARP inhibitors, they're all based on the germline. So unlike in ovary, where tumor BRCA mutations are indicated for PARP inhibitor therapy, that's not the case in breast. And so we need to demonstrate germline mutation.
So for practical purposes, that pushed you towards germline. Mike, how about in pancreatic cancer? If you have a situation, we'll talk about what that might be, maybe any patient with metastatic, maybe any patient with pancreatic, but what's your strategy going
to
be?
My strategy now is to test every patient with pancreatic cancer for germline mutations, and for those with more advanced disease, which is unfortunately the majority, to also test them for the somatic mutations.
And in terms of germline panel or BRCA?
Germline panel, germline HRD panel.
Emmanuel, what's your strategy in prostate?
Metastatic prostate cancer, everybody starts with a somatic, and then you work backwards. And then with high-risk localized, you start with germline because there's no clinical need at that moment to know the somatic status, but you need to inform the family.
So when Emmanuel submitted a slide, I saw these slides on the NCCN guidelines. I'm like, I don't remember seeing all this stuff. And you said it's actually just about to come online. You're on that committee. Can you just briefly talk about, and you're going to get more into your talk, but just as a preview of that, what the NCCN came up with this committee? Because I was like, whoa. Like Gleason 8 gets BRCA testing.
Right, so the NCCN Committee for Prostate Cancer looks at two categories, germline testing. So let's take that first. For germline testing, anyone who presents with metastatic disease buys germline testing, and anyone that has non-metastatic disease that has a Gleason score 8 and above gets germline testing. And the somatic testing is very simple. It's anyone that presents with metastatic disease.
So let's just go through sort of the clinical paradigm in ovarian cancer. We're going to work through the clinical paradigm in each one of these cancers very quickly. We can and have, and you know, at SGO, we spend 2 hours talking about this, but let's just sort of go through it quickly. So Katie, a very common situation. Patient has debulking surgery, has a BRCA germline mutation. They're destined to get what I would call adjuvant chemo, or you guys don't necessarily call it that, but carboplatin. And the audience says that in general, they're going to follow that up with olaparib. That's based on the data from the SOLO-1 trial you're going to present. Seems like that's straightforward at this point, Katie. But the other issue that's kind of interesting is whether you bring bevacizumab in, because bevacizumab was actually recently approved in this setting, particularly the high-risk setting. Lots of questions. Do you add Bev in? Do you just use a PARP inhibitor? A lot of people use Bev during the chemo and then PARP inhibitor. Katie, what do you visualize as the acceptable alternatives, and what do you do?
Well, I'm first glad to see that 92% of patients are going to use olaparib in the frontline. That's reassuring, because that is the standard of care. There's not another standard of care. It is the standard of care. The results of SOLO-1 are unprecedented, and so there's not an equivalent option for these patients. And they should be offered olaparib and potentially another PARP inhibitor. And I feel very strongly about that. I guess I am biased, but you can't argue with a difference of 3 years in progression-free survival, I don't think. So that is the standard of care. I understand why people want to add bevacizumab. We know in several studies in ovarian cancer, when you add bevacizumab to chemotherapy, it does improve markedly the response rates. And so more so I understand it in the recurrent setting where you're really trying to optimize the number of patients you get into a very good response so you can put them on one of three approved PARP inhibitors in that setting. In the frontline, you know, even in patients with bulky disease, the likelihood of achieving a complete response is very high. And so how much bevacizumab adds to that, I don't know that we really know. But I understand why people want to do it to try and optimize outcomes. There is a study that will result this year called PAOLA-1, which is ex-US, and it was run just a little bit after SOLO-1 and randomizes patients in Europe where bevacizumab is the standard of care with chemo and to follow. Once they had a complete or partial response, they were randomized to continue bevacizumab and placebo versus bevacizumab for 15 cycles and olaparib for 24 cycles as per SOLO-1. And it's stratified by BRCA mutation. So you have BRCA patients who received bevacizumab as alone, which of course we would not think is an acceptable comparator. So I think that's going to be a safety data set for this, and it will give us information in the wild type patients more than the BRCA patients. I think it's going to be a little uninformative in that group, but it'll at least give us safety data. I don't think there's data for this yet, but I don't think it's necessarily egregious to do.
So a couple other clinical points, and then we'll take a look at the data. So another question, we're going to go back and forth all night about the implication of somatic BRCA, but in this situation, the audience is saying somatic, they're going to get a PARP inhibitor. I think almost everybody in the audience says that, and that is part of the indication, correct? The solo one post some type of PARP inhibitor, even if it's somatic, okay? And a little bit different than where we are right now with breast cancer, but completely accepted, standard care, approved. Then we have this situation, which came up actually at the SGO meeting. We had some cases presented from the audience, and somebody had a patient who had gotten prior debulking surgery a year ago and wanted to use delayed PARP therapy. Interesting concept. Katie, the audience seems like they might be up for it even as much as a year ago, a year after the initial diagnosis. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, this is, I mean, as with any new indication, when you have patients that sort of missed the time window, it's so hard. I mean, I really do genuinely feel for these women that are in this gray zone, but we have no data to start olaparib a year after completion of chemotherapy in someone who is otherwise without evidence of disease. And you may just be wasting a very effective therapy that she's going to need later. So you're really sort of walking without data. And I'll show you the survival curves when we get to solo one. The theory that we have is that the benefit of maintenance olaparib is probably very early in addressing the clonality of the tumor that's left after you've done induction chemotherapy. So it's a very early effect that seems to be maintained. So starting someone even 6 months beyond on this, I really can't support, although fully acknowledge what a difficult decision and conversation that is with patients. But I don't think we have the data to support that at all.
So it'd be interesting to get some of the faculty input as we go along. I never heard this before, this vision that Katie has that it's an early effect, at least in this sort of adjuvant situation. Katie, we know that in the relapse situation and platinum-sensitive relapse that you all define as somebody who hasn't had a platinum agent in like 6 months or so, they have three approved PARP inhibitors, niraparib, rucaparib, and olaparib. It kind of seems like they're all used interchangeably. And BRCA germline standard, a lot of debate, because you have great data in wild-type disease. It definitely reduces risk of relapse. Then you have the idea of BEV as an alternative. Any comments about where we are right now with PARP inhibitors in patients who missed the initial opportunity and now have platinum-sensitive relapse? How are these patients being approached? And is there any preference about which PARP inhibitor is being used since all three are approved?
So the indication in the platinum-sensitive recurrent setting is a lot different than the frontline setting. So in the platinum-sensitive recurrent setting, you not only have to be what we call platinum-sensitive, or more appropriately, platinum eligible. So you've gone enough from your first platinum that you feel like it's reasonable to use platinum again, and you respond to that platinum. So you're selecting out a group of patients who are very responsive to chemotherapy, and you have either a complete or very good partial response. And then we use one of three PARP inhibitors until progression. For patients with either a somatic or a germline BRCA mutation, the choice there is clear when comparing to bevacizumab. It's a PARP inhibitor. PARP-naive patient in that setting needs a PARP inhibitor. The hazard ratios are like 0.23 to 0.3, just unbelievably positive in that high-risk setting. Because remember, all of those patients are going to recur again. We're not curing anyone in that setting. So the longer we can push off the next chemotherapy, the better our patients do. And PFS2 in all of those studies does confirm that. So that's
a germline patient you're talking
that's
about.
That's a germline patient, germline or somatic. Germline or somatic,
right.
The hazard ratios don't differ at all. 0.27, 0.27. So we don't have any reason to think that they behave differently. Now, in a BRCA wild type patient, the studies did different assays. Rucaparib looked at the loss of heterozygosity assay, that's Foundation Medicine. Niraparib, the NOVA study, used the Myriad assay, which is a combination of three tests, inclusive of loss of heterozygosity, but also has telomeric allelic imbalance and large state transitions. So the scores are a little different, but they're kind of the same. Really sort of trying to score patients who inherently have, tumors inherently have difficulty fixing their DNA. So when you look at those groups that are BRCA wild type, but HRD, however you define it, positive, they still had very favorable hazard ratios as well in the 0.39 to 0.45 range. So very positive. The conundrum is that in the completely biomarker negative group, however you looked at HRD and BRCA, if both of those were negative, those hazard ratios across the board were 0.5, which is still really a lot better than anything we've achieved thus far. And hence the indication in the platinum sensitive recurrent setting was agnostic to any biomarker. So in those latter two groups comes the sort of clinical equipoise with bevacizumab, which is used with chemo, does improve response rates, and then to follow chemo regardless of the response rate, you know, unless it's progression, of course. But if you have stable disease, people are transitioning to them to bevacizumab, and you do see a modest but statistically significant overall survival advantage, which we haven't seen yet in the PARP inhibitor studies just because we haven't gotten that far yet. So that remains to be seen. So there, I think, you know, there's definitely shared decision-making with patients, oral versus IV, you know, you can kind of line things up for patients.
And a lot of controversy among investigators. They had people change their mind. A previous symposium said one thing, yeah, and changed their mind the next. So there's a lot of controversy.
We do that.
This is the last clinical area, Katie, and you're going to maybe just briefly comment on the patient who's never had a PARP inhibitor and gets far out, third, fourth, fifth line therapy, but it's BRCA wild type, no HRD, but yet we still find a lot of people using PARP inhibitors. There are data supporting that. Any comment about using PARP inhibitors in that setting, Katie?
There is data coming out. The Quadra study actually was released today in Lancet Oncology. That's niraparib in all comers. And so we had very heavily pretreated patients. Many of them were classified as platinum resistant, biomarker negative. The response rates are pretty low. You know, it's 10% or less. But you did have disease stabilization at 4 and 6 months. That was pretty reasonable in that group, 15 to 18%. It's kind of a wishy-washy endpoint, but it is a clinically meaningful endpoint for a heavily pretreated patient who you hold stable for 6 months. So I think it's a potential. The registration path for that is a little tricky, but there is data to support a try.
So we're going to go on and bring in breast cancer. Before we do, Emmanuel, I'm just kind of curious, listening to the data that Katie presented, a lot of data on platinum followed by PARP maintenance, as you just heard, also data on monotherapy, Emmanuel. Any thoughts about which one of those strategies appeals to you more, sort of theoretically, if we do end up moving towards a unified approach, and also specifically in prostate cancer?
Well, the one question that comes up is whether there is cross-resistance between PARP inhibition and platinum therapy. And in prostate cancer, we don't use much platinum, so it's less of an issue. But my understanding is that a lot of the mechanisms that predispose to primary or early platinum resistance also induce PARP resistance as well. And on the other hand, the patients that are platinum sensitive are sort of more de facto PARP sensitive too. So maybe they have a genomic architecture that makes them sensitive to a platinum and also makes them sensitive to a PARP inhibitor. So maybe there's cross sensitivity and cross resistance.
Is it known whether, I'm trying to think about platinums and metastatic prostate cancer, do they work in wild type? Do they work in germline?
Well, there's no platinums that have been approved for prostate cancer. There was a trial with an oral platinum called Satraplatin,
right,
that was run by Cora Sternberg. And that study was negative, but it was an unselected population. And there was about a 15 to 20% objective response rate. If that study was done now, and we had selected like an HRD type of population, that may have been positive.
Interesting. All right, well, let's bring in breast cancer here. And Melinda, you were mentioning before in terms of the approval being germline, but we were curious what the audience and also the faculty think about breast cancer with somatic BRCA mutations. And about two-thirds of the audience says either they've done it or they would like to do it or if they had the right patient. Melinda, do we have the data to support that? Is it something you yourself have done or would like to do?
I have absolutely done it, both with platinum and PARP inhibitors. I think that, you know, we have a little bit of data in breast, nowhere near as much as in ovary, to support this. I think these data are being generated now, and so we hope to have more upcoming. But I think that in my experience in breast cancer with both platinum and PARP inhibitors, responses are high in breast cancer patients with tumor BRCA mutations.
So Mike, pancreas, somatic responds the same way as germline?
We don't know for sure, but yeah, we are certainly seeing responses in patients with somatic-only mutations.
So in terms of the clinical applications in breast cancer, Melinda, What's interesting in contrast to these other three cancers is kind of breast cancer is at least three diseases just based on ER and HER2, and you could say it's four. You could say if you bring in PD-1, triple negative, it starts to get even more complicated. But let's just stick with the three main situations. So most common type of breast cancer, ER positive, HER2 negative in the metastatic setting. Typically right now, Melinda, first-line metastatic disease, they're going to get hormones plus a CDK inhibitor. They might get another hormonal therapy, even if they progress right afterwards, they still might get everolimus or fulvestrant or whatever, and then they'll often go to chemo. So where in that sequence in a germline patient do you think a PARP inhibitor should fit?
Yeah, I think for us, where we're seeing it is following endocrine resistance pre-chemotherapy. That being said, I think that there are a lot of ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer patients out there with metastatic disease where we don't know that they have a BRCA mutation. And sometime down the line, after they've been heavily pretreated with chemotherapy in certain cases, you know, they have profiling of their tumor that identifies a BRCA mutation, and then we reflex to germline testing, and all along it was a BRCA-associated tumors. And we've seen this sometimes in elderly patients where the family history wasn't suggestive, they didn't meet criteria for testing. And so I think there's a lot more of later line use in the ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic patient as well.
Mike, a theme in oncology in terms of biomarkers is retesting. A lot of times CLL, people gain 17p, whatever, you have to retest. What about somatic BRCA mutations? Do you acquire them with time?
I don't think we know if you acquire somatic BRCA mutations. My gut feeling is that you don't. But one thing that I will talk about is that you can acquire secondary BRCA mutations that revert the BRCA gene
right.
to make it a functional protein, and actually that causes resistance to the PARP inhibitors.
Yeah, that's really amazing. So the second subset I want to ask you about, Melinda, less common, but still probably about 20% of breast cancer, triple negative disease. We're saying, okay, germline BRCA mutations, triple negative, where are PARP inhibitors?
Yeah, I think the paradigm has changed a little bit just because of the approval a few weeks ago of atezolizumab with nab-paclitaxel for first-line triple-negative breast cancer, but those are patients selected for PD-L1 positive status. So if we set that aside, I think that if you look at the data from the trials in breast cancer for those patients with BRCA mutations, the response rates are 60% or higher. I think many times, you know, patient with metastatic triple negative breast cancer in the first line, people really just want to give chemotherapy thinking it's better, it's stronger, but really the response rates are outstanding with single agent PARP inhibitor therapy, and that's again in a broader patient population. And so I think that I'm very comfortable using it up front.
So in the third big population, of course, in breast cancer is the HER2 population. They might be ER positive, ER negative, but in terms of this question, maybe let's just stick with ER negative just to make it simpler. Patients typically get anti-HER therapy indefinitely. Where would a PARP inhibitor fit in your algorithm? And it's not actually even approved. I don't even think it's been tested.
Yeah, I mean, and interesting what we see in breast, you know, we just really do not see BRCA mutations in patients with true HER2 positive disease. It's just not something that we clinically observe. I can think of probably a couple patients ever that I've seen that have a BRCA mutation, HER2 positive breast cancer. So, you know, there's really been, you know, no sort of real pursuit of that in breast cancer in the HER2 positive. The treatment sort of space is more complicated. And so I wouldn't rule it out, certainly, if I had a patient with a BRCA mutation, but we just don't commonly encounter them.
So then the other issue with breast cancer, as you're going to point out, is there are actually two PARP inhibitors, and one of them is not approved in ovarian cancer. So there are actually four. Pretty awesome being the general medical oncologist nowadays, you know, trying to figure all this new stuff out. Any preferences? Looks like the audience has a strong preference. Just kidding. They're completely split between olaparib, telazoparib. I have heard people say it's sort of a coin flip. Agree?
Agree.
Hard to separate them?
Yeah, I think overall, we'll look at the data a little bit, but they're very similar, the phase 3 data for both olaparib and talazoparib in breast cancer. I think, you know, olaparib's dosed twice daily, talazoparib once daily. Maybe more heme toxicity with talazoparib compared to olaparib. But again, I think they're pretty similar.
It actually reminds me of some of the debates we have about CDK inhibitors because there are three approved there. Again, pretty cool to be an oncologist trying to figure it out. You look at the toxicity profile. Katie, I kind of get the same flavor in ovary with the three. I mean, obviously, olaparib is the only one with data up front. But when you get in the relapse setting, kind of hard to separate them. People look at toxicity, method of administration, but pretty similar. Is that your take, Katie?
Yeah, these are very similar. There's not a difference in efficacy. It's just really what you're comfortable with. That's what you should use because you're going to take better care of patients using what you're comfortable using.
Let's move on to talk about pancreatic cancer. And just sort of as a prelude to that, Mike, I want to ask, you know, we brought up this question, is BRCA-ness, DRD, is this sort of the new MSI? And so to get into that, Mike, I had this sort of weird thought, which is, if you had a patient who had a metastatic gastric adenocarcinoma who happens to have a germline mutation, because let's fake it, if you don't get protected from gastric cancer or lung cancer, you get those, would you use a PARP inhibitor, which is kind of along the MSI kind of idea? Mike, what do you think?
So I personally definitely would. I have seen patients with gastric cancer. In fact, actually, gastroesophageal cancers not infrequently will have DDR or BRCA type mutations. A lot of them have ATM deficiency, kind of like prostate cancer. And definitely, if I saw a DDR deficient, BRCA mutated upper GI cancer, I would definitely consider PARP inhibitor-based therapy.
It looks like the audience kind of agreed. And I know, Katie, I originally sent this question to you, and you sent it over to your GI person, and that person said yes.
Yes.
So, but then here's the next variation, Mike, follicular lymphoma.
You know, I saw this question and I said no, but partly because follicular lymphoma has so many other good therapies, and I think that's a large part of the reason why.
Yeah,
mechanistically, biologically, I do hope that the DDR subgroup of patients does become the new MSI. There's going to be a lot more context than there is in the true MSI and checkpoint inhibitors, where there's just neoantigens released. But I think in the proper context and perhaps in the proper maintenance setting versus first line setting, drugs like PARP inhibitors or other drugs that are targeting the DNA damage repair pathway will be universally adopted across the different disease types.
So, Emmanuel, I mean, again, your place was really a leader in the whole MSI story. Now you hear people talking about doing MSI testing on every adenocarcinoma or metastatic, every solid tumor, every cancer. Are we heading in that direction in terms of DRD in general, Emmanuel? And you think it's just going to be solid tumors or every cancer?
Well, I don't think I'm drinking the Kool-Aid with respect to hematological malignancies. I do buy the solid tumor principle or biological principle, but I think hematological cancers develop in different ways with different molecular drivers. So I'm on the fence there.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about pancreatic cancer. And again, Mike, let's just quickly go through sort of the clinical algorithms. So the first question is, would you administer a PARP inhibitor to someone who has a germline mutation, metastatic disease? We figured most people would say yes, but what I was really curious about is how. And maybe it depends on how people read their press releases or whatever, but looks like the audience is split between monotherapy and platinum-based chemo. Mike, how do you answer the question?
So I would prefer to use it in the maintenance setting after platinum-based therapy, and not just because of the POLO study that results that I'll talk about. I think that pancreatic cancer in general is a difficult disease to treat. We don't have the luxury of having these wonderful responses to single-agent therapies as we do in breast, ovarian, and prostate cancer. And I think that the tumors need a big smack on the head first with chemotherapy, followed by a more gentle PARP inhibitor-type maintenance therapy.
So another issue that we wanted to see what the audience says about, you know, there are obviously a lot of other germline mutations. I'll be honest with you, I never heard of CHK2 until I saw your slides, but I looked it up. Guess I'm not alone since half the audience doesn't sound like they know about it. But in any event, Mike, what's CHK2? And if you knew somebody had a germline CHK2 mutation, would you consider a PARP inhibitor if you could?
So I would in pancreatic cancer, again, because pancreatic cancer is a disease where we're desperate for new ways and novel angles to try and treat a very deadly disease. Do we have any data that this will work? No, unfortunately not at all. I don't think really across most cancers, we don't really have data that a CHK2 mutation definitively predicts for responsiveness to a PARP inhibitor.
And then, of course, the issue, as we just talked about with the other two tumors, is when. And it looks like the audience is thinking more second or third line therapy. We should reflect on the fact that while, you know, we do have chemotherapy, FOLFIRINOX, GEMNAB, they do cause responses. It's not necessarily non-toxic by any means and not very long. Mike, where do you think right now you would like to put PARP inhibitor?
So I'm really glad you presented this slide because I think one background to think about when reviewing this slide is that currently only 50% of pancreatic cancer patients with advanced disease get any chemotherapy at all. And of those, only 50% get second-line chemotherapy. So there's somewhere between up to as many as 75% of patients with pancreatic cancer who never even get second-line therapy.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, so we're missing our chance if we don't give it first-line. Now, of course, the dilemma is trying to get the testing done in a reasonable time. These are patients who don't go on six cycles of carboplatin initially, and we need to get those results right away. That's why the maintenance setting is really good, where you've given them a few cycles of standard chemotherapy, and you have your answer as to their germline or somatic molecular testing in time for giving them the PARP inhibitor for those who have BRCA or similar types of mutations. But if you wait to third line, forget about it. They're going to be too far gone.
So the other thing, and this was sparked by a slide I saw in your deck, which I thought was really interesting, and Melinda referred to it in breast, is this issue of, you know, sort of cross resistance with platinums, and do you see responses after platinums? I hadn't seen very much data until I saw your slide, and looks like actually in terms of the answer, how would you answer this question? Is there evidence that you do benefit? Are you going to show the slide? My take was the answer is no.
Yeah, the answer seems to be no. It is,
at least in pancreas.
In pancreas, it still is early, but the data is definitely developing that patients who have had platinum and frankly progressed, so these are not just platinum exposed, because sometimes with FOLFIRINOX, we'll drop the oxaliplatin after 4 to 8 cycles or so. But if those are patients that frankly progressed on platinum-based therapy, they will almost certainly not respond subsequently on a PARP inhibitor.
So we're going to finish out talking about prostate cancer. I can tell you, when we had the faculty, we always meet with the faculty ahead of time for about 45 minutes, and my brain was like on fire by the time I walked out of that room, let alone here talking to these four very learned people. But let's bring in prostate cancer. And Emmanuel, before you start going through the data, I was just kind of curious where you are right now in terms of where you think PARP inhibitors fit in. And here we asked a couple of questions to the audience to sort of lead into your discussion. So there's been a lot of really amazing research coming out in prostate cancer in the M0 space the last few years. That's PSA-only disease. They have a patient who typically might have had prior prostatectomy, radiation therapy, then they develop PSA elevation. You image them, you can't find anything. The PSA keeps going up, and of course Hopkins has really had a traditional leadership role for many, many years about defining how to approach these patients. Now we're seeing secondary hormonal therapy. You know, previously these people get androgen deprivation, now they're getting enzalutamide, apalutamide, a new agent just was presented at ASCO GU, darolutamide. So my question to you is, if you know you have a patient who has a BRCA germline mutation, Emmanuel, we'll get to metastatic disease, but would you consider using it in a patient with PSA-only disease? For example, a patient who's already gotten androgen deprivation, then they relapse, then they get, like, say, enzalutamide, and then they relapse. I don't know how often you see it. We know these people are very, very close to metastatic disease. They may be close to mortality. The audience says, yeah, they do it. How about you?
Well, that would be on the fringe of reality. With metastatic disease, we're going to have hopefully an indication within the next 1 to 2 years in the second and third line setting. So after the patient has failed abiraterone or enzalutamide plus one chemotherapy. So moving that into the non-metastatic setting, even if they're post-enzalutamide, I think is a bit of a stretch. However, we do have a study at Hopkins with PSA-only M0 disease where we wrote an IIT, investigator-initiated trial, to look at a PARP inhibitor or olaparib. And as you know, with IITs, the FDA has to give you the green light to proceed. And we wrote the protocol, and they actually declined it. So I got a letter from the FDA, this study is unethical.
Wow.
And we actually pushed back, and we were able to convince them with appropriate safety monitoring to allow us to do the study, and we've seen responses. But outside of the Johns Hopkins crazy people that do these types of things, I would not recommend it. So let's leave it at that.
You know, one of the things I've learned from Emmanuel and his colleagues is that you can have PSA-only disease and still have a bad prognosis if you're resistant to therapy, have a high doubling time, and we'll see what happens with your study and where this heads. But a much more practical question, Emmanuel, is where in the metastatic setting you might place it. So we, you know, typically people might get CIP-T, cipuleucel-T. Some people do, some people don't. But certainly either enzalutamide or abiraterone, a lot of patients get both. But then the question is, let's just say you've had a patient's gotten all that, what's next? Is it going to be chemo, for example, docetaxel is a typical chemotherapy, or PARP inhibitor? And it looks like the audience is kind of split between whether to go with chemo or PARP inhibitor after hormones. Emmanuel, what are you doing?
I think if a patient has received novel AR-targeting therapy like enzalutamide or abiraterone, and they're chemotherapy ineligible or they decline chemotherapy, that would be appropriate. But the FDA label most likely is going to say that you have to have failed one chemotherapy as well, based on the trial design.
Is that where you'd like to use it? Do you think that's in the best interest of the patient?
I'd like to use it before chemotherapy.
Before chemo. Okay, great. So let's talk about one other question I was just kind of curious about. We've heard about cytopenias. We talked about anemia, for example. Just kind of curious, because in metastatic prostate, you often have extensive bone mets. I was kind of curious, do you see more cytopenias with PARP inhibitors in patients with a lot of bone mets?
Well, obviously, the more bone mets you have, the more myelophysic anemia you can develop. We do see more anemia with olaparib, specifically in people that have a lot of bone disease. We also see a lot of thrombocytopenia, for some reason, more with niraparib. So the answer is yes. If you have a high, you know, disease burden in the bone with bone marrow invasion, myelophysic anemia to begin with, hemoglobin less than 9, those patients are going to have trouble.
So we're going to close out with just a couple of quick things. First, a question to Katie, and then I'm going to turn to Melinda and Mike and just see if there are any thoughts they have after hearing their colleagues present all these things. But first, a question that I had, at least coming into the faculty room, but Katie kind of tried to help me explain it. So my naive question was, Katie, do patients who have BRCA germline mutations have more toxicity from PARP inhibitors?
No.
You say that you get that question from naive people like me. Can you explain to us why not? I think it ties into what Emmanuel was saying about the lack of the second hit
right.
in the normal cells. Can you kind of just go through that again?
That's exactly it. I think there's this, I don't know where it came from, but it's this belief that patients with BRCA mutations have more hematologic toxicity from their baseline chemotherapy and likely more hematologic toxicity from PARP inhibitors, and that's why they're susceptible to MDS and AML, but they don't have a second hit in their bone marrow. And so there's just no truth to that. And we're going to present some data finally that shows that. So it's not true, but you see people like altering the chemotherapy they pick for patients so it's less hematologically toxic because they're worried about this. And there's just no, I don't know where it came from, these myths.
There has been the question out there, though, now with PARP inhibitors being used earlier and earlier, Katie, whether or not it maybe interferes with future chemotherapy in terms of bone marrow reserve. Do we know anything about that?
We know some. I think this is something we're going to have to follow very closely. We have fortunately been treating patients with PARP inhibitors, at least in the ovarian and breast cancer space, for a decade or more. And we have randomized data from study 19, which was Jonathan Lederman's original randomized trial in the recurrent setting, where patients are still being followed on that study with 8 years of PARP inhibitor use, but they followed those patients out to overall survival, and there was never a decrement in their subsequent responses to therapy. And the nominal P looked statistically significant, but because they peeked at the data too many times, they couldn't call it significant. So if anything, the benefit was maintained over years of use. Now that's in the recurrent setting. So you're kind of starting a little bit down the pathway. Now it's moving upfront for BRCA patients, and it may move up in subgroups for non-BRCA. I think we'll see what happens this year. I don't think we're going to see that. We haven't seen a signal, but I do think we learn things from doing trials, and we have to pay attention.
So closing comments, Melinda, any thoughts about this experience here?
I mean, I think that my takeaway from just listening to everyone is that ovarian cancer is really just a different disease. And I think my feeling is more similar to, based on my experience, you know, sort of the feeling in pancreas that all of these mutations in the HR pathway, they're not created equal. That, you know, we see clinically that probably PALB2 is the one that is behaving most like BRCA2 in breast. And so I do think that there's something there. Those data, again, are going to be forthcoming. But, you know, I think that if we look ahead to really be more precise about selecting the optimal patients, I think we need to have, you know, the germline status. And I think we need to really look to see, has there been that second hit? You know, is there LOH, loss of heterozygosity, in that tumor? And that it likely explains a lot for breast and probably, it sounds like, for prostate in terms of why we don't see responses in some of these cases.
Final comment from Mike?
I have three summary comments. The cross-pollination was really helpful. First of all, with the ovarian cancer data that was so strong in the sort of pseudo-adjuvant setting, I'll call it, tells us that we really need to think about doing this in the adjuvant setting for pancreatic cancer. We know most patients with pancreatic cancer, their disease recurs, and if we can actually have the kinds of curves that we did in ovarian cancer with long-term PARP inhibitor use for the DDR-deficient subgroup of patients, that could be a remarkable sea change for pancreatic cancer. The second thing I didn't realize is that with so much success, I think in some ways we see more resistance develop earlier in pancreatic cancer. And so I think we can maybe turn the tables and teach the other colleagues how to look for resistance pathways sooner. And then the universal theme is that we really need to be testing these patients for germline mutations and for somatic mutations.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio spinoff program of a satellite CME symposium held at the 2019 AACR meeting.